Today on the 75 podcast, we're going to be discussing Alyssa Slotkin, Senator from Michigan, her recent speech that she gave to the Center for American Progress, in which she discussed her economic war plan for the American middle class. In the speech, she describes what she considers to be the greatest threat to America currently as the declining middle class. And in this speech, she outlines five critical pillars that she views as the areas to focus our attention, which are good paying jobs, modernizing education, affordable housing, and all of the above energy policy, and accessible, affordable healthcare. She also identifies the need for campaign finance reform, or the addressing of big money in politics. And we were obviously, as the 75 Coalition, going to address that as part of our discussion. A key central theme to Senator Slotkin's speech was the need for political reform in banning corporate PAC money, restricting stock trading by members of Congress and their families, and just overall healthcare and pharmaceutical lobbying reform. So she sees these as essential to restoring public trust and making progress on kitchen table issues like wages, housing, and healthcare costs.
Have you ever wondered how our political system became so intertwined with big money? Well, it wasn't always like this. Decades ago, there were limits and regulations in place to prevent corruption and ensure fair elections. But then came a series of pivotal court decisions that established that money equals speech, setting the stage for the wealthy to have an outsized influence on politics. It's no wonder that over 75% of Americans believe it's time to take big money out of politics. Join us as we explore how money influences U.S. politics in profound and sometimes unsettling ways. The 75 Podcast starts now.
Welcome to the 75 Podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about, of course, money in politics, but specifically, we're going to talk a little bit about Alyssa Slotkin and her speech that she gave recently to the Center for American Progress on June 26th. In this speech, she outlines what she calls the economic war plan for the American middle class, which outlines five pillars of five areas of focus. And, you know, we're going to talk about this, her proposal and how money in politics ties in with each of these. We're hoping to have it to be an open-ended discussion. And I'm really pleased to welcome back two of our founding members from the 75 Coalition, Maggie Bowman, who is in addition to her full-time job, she is a writer and a creator, a bridge builder, and somebody trying to work to bridge the divide and find that common ground. And also joined with Frank Botina. And Frank is a former military. He's a small business owner, father, and concerned citizen, and potential somebody who might be running for U.S. House of Representatives in maybe 2026, if we're so lucky. So I want to thank Maggie and Frank for joining me again on the show. And so let's start with maybe, I think, is the most critical or the most important quote that Alyssa Slotkin, Senator Slotkin, gave at the end, near the end of her speech, which is this: "If you want to know why all Americans are furious about the price of healthcare and nothing ever changes, it's because of this very ugly reality. Lobbyists and corporate PACs donate a lot of money, and then members of Congress feel beholden to protect those industries." I think that says a lot, you know, about the kind of the central issue. She left it towards the end of her speech, which I felt was interesting as one. But why don't we start with this, Maggie and Frank. Maybe Maggie, if you want to go first. What did you think about overall maybe her speech and where it maybe hit the mark or maybe where it missed the mark?
Look, I think she definitely gave it's a good speech and it gives some really great points and a really great ideas, but at the same time, in my opinion, it doesn't maybe push far enough that it.
Yeah.
While she frames it in a new way that not a lot of people have necessarily done it before as a war plan, she kind of still gives the same ideas that we've heard over and over again. But I do appreciate that she brings up that the lobbyists and the corporate PACs and how the money influences it. And I think that's something that whether you're more progressive or more centrist or more conservative, either way, it needs to be brought up more often. And her as a centrist, I do appreciate that she brought it up.
Yeah, she mentions herself as one of 6 out of 100 senators that refuse corporate PAC money, which is like astonishing that the number is that low. Mm-hmm. And honestly, when you think about it, I don't know the other ones that refuse it besides probably Bernie Sanders. I don't know which other ones are refusing corporate PAC money. Interesting to go and try and find out who those other ones are. And I plan on doing that and talking about them as well in the future. So Frank, what do you think about the general state of, you know, we can talk about the money in politics side, or if you want to focus it on healthcare, her quote, focus a little bit on healthcare as well.
Well, before we do that, I wanted to ask Maggie, what does she feel are the topics or the things that keep coming up that, you know, I guess maybe they just pay lip service to, or which ones you were talking about, perhaps?
The idea for, gotta make more jobs. We gotta have immigration reform. We need to have education reform. We need to do all this. And then they say all that and they come up with some cool buzzwords but then they don't do anything about it, or they do the exact opposite. So it's always like, I mean, they'll talk a lot about what they're going to do about, so they'll give out the buzzword, give out the buzzwords of what the people really care about, but then no follow through.
Yeah, that's fair. It is interesting to see them, you know, talking about the lobby, about all that money and the lobbying, the super PACs and all that. I don't know if necessarily she's the best messenger for that, because I was just looking up her record. Apparently she used to be like some kind of consultant for like the Department of Defense or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm pretty sure she's made money in that sector. And then some of her votes are questionable.
She's worked for the government. Yeah, she worked for the government in the Department of Defense.
No, yeah, CIA. But it was saying she also, once she got out, she was also a consultant as well.
It's a little, like, where exactly did she benefit from it before? And is she genuine is she actually authentic in saying that this is what we need to look at now? Because she could own up to it and say, hey, I did benefit from this in the past.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think I'd be more impressed if someone did that and say, and this is why I won't do it again, you know?
Yeah. One of the things I felt like when I was listening to it was, all of these things that she's outlining are needs, right? Jobs that pay enough, right? And making sure that we have jobs with the changing technology so that we're staying ahead of technology with the training and the education that are needed to make sure that, today's kids that are going to be, 35 years old in the year 2050 or 25 years old in the year 2050, that they have the skills needed to be successful in that decade. right? And in the future, it's crazy to think that we're only 25 years away from 2050. You know, and housing. So her, you know, her five pillars. I jumped right into the quote because I feel like that's central to what we're doing. But really, the five pillars that she's laying out is jobs, right? That can create a middle class, all right? That allow you to work hard, pay your bills, but also save some money, right? Schooling, as I just mentioned, to make sure that we're educating and teaching critical thinking in schools. It seems like maybe we've stepped away from that. That's a common thing I hear from people, that schools are not teaching critical thinking in America. Housing, God, the housing ownership problems and struggles that people have, especially on the coasts, but also in any outside the suburbs of any major city today, the housing costs are so astronomically high. And put on top of that, energy costs, right? So affordable energy, access to energy. And then the last thing that we need is critical as well, is healthcare, affordable, accessible healthcare. So those are the five pillars that she outlines in there. My takeaway, one of them, you know, Frank, question to you is so how can any of this be done when we have systemic money and politics problem, right? Where special interests, right? Special interests are just the ones that can afford to buy their interests. Those are the special interests. I don't know why they get such a cool name, right?
By their PR schools.
I have interest, and they are special.
I have special interest too. I just can't afford to, I guess, pay the politicians. But you know, the current system, how are we ever going to get progress in these areas if it goes against the desires of special interests, right? So, what do you think? Open-ended question, Frank, about just the general speech and, you know, these five pillars.
Yeah. Well, like what she's saying sounds good. And, you know, it's good to hear more and more politicians talking, you know, talking out about money in politics and lobbying and all that. But I just seeing in her record real quick, like I really don't think she really means it. But it's still good to hear people say it, even if they don't mean it, because the more people say it, the more it's okay to say it, for them to say it. At one point or another, I could see people actually trying to, you know, to hold them accountable because they are saying these things. Because when before, they would not even mention these type of things, you know? Because even though she mentioned how about, like, you know, we got to get Congress members to stop, you know, being able to buy stocks and stuff like that. Apparently, she's worth like $5 million or more. And some of it was done from working with the government and investments, including stocks and stuff like that. So, which is why one of the other reasons I don't really believe she really means it. But besides that, I feel like it's getting both harder and perhaps easier to change it. Harder because, you know, the Supreme Court, the way it is, it seems like anything that we try to, that we get, we are able to pass, can get challenged by the Supreme Court, and more than likely it won't go our way just because of how conservative it is. But I would say it might be easier just because so many people, more and more people are seeing how broken our system is. And people are just getting desperate. And that's usually what causes, you know, revolutions or big changes, is when people get desperate, because, you know, sooner or later things break.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's what she kind of gets at with the decline, or the, you know, the path of the middle class, the dissolution, right? The dissolving of the American middle class is going to end up resulting in a lot of anger, and it already really has to, but we might not have hit the bottom yet. And I don't know, you know, we don't need to get into the new mega bill that just passed, but I don't know if that helps or hurts. I mean, you hear from one side, it's going to be an economic rocket ship that everybody's going to benefit from. But it's hard to necessarily believe that. As you mentioned, you know, there's so much political theater out there. And it's hard to know if Alyssa Slotkin is fully behind the message that she's saying or if it's theater.
Yeah.
And same thing with, you know, a mega bill that locks in the tax reform that's really costing America a great deal of money on our national debt. So
what was expected, like over $3 trillion, like over 10 years or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. By the continuation of law, tax law that was put in place before. So like the tax law was supposed to expire and now it's considered permanent. So by doing that, it ends up estimating to be like another $3 trillion on top of the $36-37 trillion that we're already underwater. So
and it keeps the wealthiest among us from paying their fair share, and all the loopholes, it just solidifies and the loopholes that they've had, and it just puts the burden on those of us who don't have those massive the income.
It's hard to. Oh, sorry, Maggie.
No, go ahead.
Sorry, I stepped on your comment there. Okay. And it's hard to see like how this bill then promotes growth for the middle class, right? So, you know, and there's 1,000 pages of it, and it's more than a single person could digest in this short period of time from it being introduced to being passed. So. And I know as the American public, we really haven't been informed on what's in there. We don't know what the changes that were just introduced and approved. You know,
well, even some of the politicians were saying that they didn't read the whole thing. You know, they probably either they didn't have time or they didn't feel like doing the job or the work or whatever. But a lot of them didn't even read it themselves. So if they're not reading it, then when they are in charge of doing that, that's basically their job.
Yeah, exactly. It's their job to not only represent the people, but to also do what the people need them to do. Like, the people don't have the bandwidth to read something like that. They're supposed to have the bandwidth to read something like that. So the fact that they don't do it is really frustrating.
Yeah, and that's like the main reason, was one of the main reasons they're getting elected, you know, to do this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, who wrote it also?
Right.
I mean, I think that we know that these laws are written from the lobbyists, and so as changes come in, those changes come in through the lobbyists too. So it's so easy to slip in changes that don't benefit Americans into these bills because they're so long, and you have, you know, and we've seen that in the past with loopholes get put into bills to. You know, the Affordable Health Care Act back when that was first put in. And so anyway, I know this episode wasn't about talking about that bill, but it's almost impossible
not to talk about it.
Yeah. And her speech came right before it was passed. Yeah. And then with the Independence Day coming and it being signed.
The one thing that I noticed is that it seems like it's always the tax breaks for usually like the corporations or the top percent that usually get those to become permanent. But a lot of like the child, you know, a lot of the child credit, whatever Biden, I forgot what Biden put, was it the Child Credit Act or something?
Child care. They know.
The child care.
Child care.
Yeah, whichever that one that helped. And reduce poverty for children in the U.S. Like stuff like that, you don't see that become permanent, but you see all these other, you know, tax cuts for corporations. Those keep over and over again, start become permanent. The Bush tax credits or the tax cuts that Bush did, they also became permanent under Biden. So we can't just say it's Trump. It's also unfortunately the Democrats that do it as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's like the central issue for the wealthy donors, corporations,
mm-hmm.
special interests is going to be tax credits because that's their biggest, one of their biggest expense line items on their P&L.
Yeah, well, they're definitely getting their money's worth.
So, yeah. You know, the interesting thing that she also mentions in this is the double dipping aspect of it. So, major corporations will not pay their employees enough. And those employees work a full-time job, possibly two jobs, to pay their bills, to try to put food on their table. And yet it's still not enough because the wages aren't high enough in the areas that they live in. So they have to be on welfare and food stamps still. Mm-hmm. And so the taxpayers, the American taxpayers, the middle class that pay the vast majority of the of taxes, they have to now fund corporations that don't pay their employees enough, you know, through welfare programs.
And it's not just that, though. Like, if you look up,
she brings up the fact that under this plan, like, that's got to stop. You cannot have this double dipping and giving out subsidies for R&D research or other government-funded, you know, tax incentive programs when a corporation is not paying their employees enough money.
Yeah, it's worse than that because a lot of times these corporations, as I've noticed lately, don't give a lot of their employees full time anymore.
Yeah.
They'll give them just enough so they don't have to give them any more benefits.
Yeah.
So not only are they not getting any benefits, they're probably not making enough because of the wage. And if they make too much, they might even qualify for some of those resources that maybe before they would have qualified for.
You make too much to qualify and not enough to survive.
Exactly.
Yeah, another thing that she highlights in there that I liked is support for unions, right? So when you have the kind of the corrupt system that we have, and when the special interests are able to buy the politicians, you're going to have real pushback on labor unions.
Yeah,
and that's what we've seen with the railroad labor unions, or you know, the restaurant labor unions as well.
Automotive,
yeah. Just not a support.
What's so crazy is that, like, technically, labor unions would be considered a special interest, like, if you like define it, like, but it's a special interest for the people. It's in general, like, for the laborers, for the people who are doing the work that the rich people are benefiting from. So that's what the unions are there. That's their special interest, and the demonization of them is so wrongly placed. The demonizing of unions, it needs to be flipped, and the appropriate special interests should be the ones that are being demonized.
It raises an interesting question, though. If, you know, we were to try and get money out of politics with a constitutional amendment, is it all or nothing? So, you know, do the labor union political contributions need to stop as well? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can belong to a labor union, but that labor union cannot take your dues or request money from you and then do kind of like a pooling of money to buy politicians. Does that need to stop as well?
Yeah, I would say so.
What do you think, Frank? Yeah.
Yeah, and if we want to be fair about it, that should include them as well. And not just that, if they're not allowed to do it, it might help them save money for other things that they could use, whether it's, you know, for lawsuits or whatever that they normally use it for instead of lobbying.
Yeah, I think there's other ways that they could be influential aside from buying politicians. Or donating to their campaigns.
Which most of the time, they don't tend to get very much from them anyways, yeah. And if they donate.
Yeah. So there's a lot better ways to be influential.
I wonder how they would feel. You know, the heads of I imagine the heads of the labor unions would probably not support it, but I imagine the members of the unions probably would. Curious to know what the kind of the opinion is, you know, the polling on that is. Because all or not, because if you only take it away from corporations and you leave labor unions, and that's not really necessarily fair either. And the strange thing is, our history is corporations got their political spending off the backs of the labor union's political spending. So labor unions came first in the 50s buying politicians, and then corporations 10, 15 years later in the 70s, they started buying politicians. So yeah. I felt like that was interesting when I learned the history. Like, oh, interesting that it kind of snuck in this way.
Yeah. There's always, whenever there's people who have some sort of position of power, whether it's a position of power that's supposed to be supporting the people or a position of power that's about making money, it's still about power, and power always gets corrupted. So you have to be held to a certain standard. You always have to be held accountable in order for power to really properly be instituted. So when labor unions had leaders who were corrupt, when corporations have leaders who are corrupt, it's all the same thing. And there's that, what's the accountability mechanism?
Yeah, because the unions are not immune from being corrupt themselves either.
Uh-huh.
And no one is. Yeah, and if corporations are blocked, they might find ways around it by using the unions to try to, continue the influence.
Yeah.
So it would make more sense just to take it away from everybody.
One of the biggest things that I'm hearing or reading about today is, of course, AI and the impact that AI will most likely have on American jobs. So it was the CEO of Anthropic, which is the company that owns the AI system called, or maybe you guys can help me out with the name of it, Claude.
Yeah,
right?
Claude.
And it's a really powerful AI tool. And he said basically half of American jobs, I mean, it was some astronomical number, are going to be lost over some stretch of time. And, I hear other people say, these jobs will be replaced by other jobs, which is possible. But that is a major threat. Senator Slotkin mentions AI as part of her focus on jobs. But money in politics and the technology oligarch, right, or the main powers in technology right now today, it's a scary, frightening situation that we have, mixture that we have going on right now.
Yeah, and their ideologies as well. But that's a whole other story. But their influence, I guess, that something about the Big Beautiful Bill, part of something that was taken out was the fact that the tech oligarchs wanted that states couldn't regulate AI for 10 years. That was something that was in the bill, but then they took it out before they voted on it. And the tech oligarchs weren't too happy about that because they wanted that. They didn't want states to be able to regulate AI.
How did it even get in there in the first place? It's just crazy to me.
They probably wrote that portion of the bill themselves and gave it to, whoever Congress people they've been paying off. And
yeah,
allegedly
they're lobbying. No, well, it's not. It's
not really allowed.
It's totally legal. It's totally legal, to do this stuff. So that is the creed. And that's what everybody knows. It's just not discussed ever. It's right. It's not discussed on the news or the media. So then nobody ends up talking about it but we all know it's true. So that's why we're here.
Exactly.
So we're here to talk about it. So
I think we're just everyday people, just like so many other people that we're hoping to reach. Whereas we're in similar situations that you're in. Some of us we may be more vulnerable than others, but we're all still part of what was the middle class in the United States and is now shrinking, and most of us are being pushed down into what would be considered a lower class, which doesn't have to, the people in that class aren't bad people. It's just, it's socioeconomic, it's economic more than anything. And that, but so many of us are getting pushed down into it, and it's just becoming the lowest class is getting bigger and bigger. And we're all, the poverty level in the United States is just hitting so many more people.
Yeah, it's exploding.
Yeah.
It really is. It's multiplying, right? And I don't know, do you see, you guys are in California, so I imagine you see homeless encampments?
Mm-hmm. Well, all the time.
Yeah.
Some places more than others, but we do see it.
Yeah, the more affluent areas, the people will fight more to make sure it's not in their yard. But the especially like outside my work, there's a street behind our parking lot, and there's RVs up and down. There's tents up and down that street. The businesses in the area put up like concrete pillars to keep some areas, try and keep them from doing it. There's other cities that put up spikes in areas to keep homeless people from sleeping there, which I think is just downright cruel. But because I'm in LA County, Frank's in Orange County, and then there's other, I mean, even up all the way up in the Bay Area, and it's a problem all throughout the state, and even in areas that are may not as heavily be as heavily populated, but not as many people want to live in those areas. Even the homeless unhoused population, they would rather live and where there's more people, so because there's also more resources available. But even then, California spent billions of dollars that was supposed to go to the homeless.
No, it was pretty much wasted.
Supposed to go to building housing,
mm-hmm.
right? It was supposed to try and go to building actual, you know, units for put roofs over people's heads to house people, and that didn't seem to happen. And one of the things that Senator Slotkin mentions is the fact that there's like overlapping regulations that make it hard for builders. It sounded like a little bit of an excuse to me, but I believe in what she's saying, that there's overregulation in housing, especially in California.
Compared to
other places. So
yeah. California, the desire to want to be environmentally friendly and, you know, and such, that it creates some laws. When new laws are introduced, they will block other things that were already in place. So then it creates this combination of bottlenecks and backlogs and just like walls that are there. So it's the good intention stuff ends up creating more problems in the end. The whole thing needs to be redone.
What do you mean by the whole thing needs to get redone?
I think by the whole if we want to build more environmentally friendly, more sustainable way, and more climate friendly ways and such, then just look at all the laws already in place, where they can be adjusted, what amendments can be made to the ones that are already in place instead of throwing in new ones. Mm-hmm. Like they'd still have to be voted on, like depending on the type of law that it is. Because in California, we have laws that are either passed by the state government or they're laws that the people have voted on. So depending on what it originated as, the people may have to vote on, and I don't know if they'd have to vote on like an amendment, but how is it going to change? Because instead of throwing new things on over and over, and it's like constantly throwing a Band-Aid over it over and over, but the wound is still rotting underneath. So
some of it's also like implementation, or a lot of it's implementation. They find ways around it by either giving it to people that are going to charge way too much, or whoever's got preferential choice of choosing. They get to choose certain contractors. To which, and I feel like there's not enough. Either there's not enough in the laws to regulate it or to make sure that it's being done properly, or they're simply not enforcing it, yeah. Or both. I mean, I guess it could be both too. Yeah, because they've gotten money to provide affordable housing, but they've just spent too much on it. When clearly they know how to build houses. I mean, you gotta tell me the government doesn't know how to build affordable housing. Mm-hmm. They've done it before. They could do it again. To me, it just sounds like they don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not a real desire. There's not a real profit motive. And I think that's where the money and politics aspect comes into play with this issue is, well, what's the motivation if we're not going to make money off of it? So when the politicians aren't being motivated because they don't really have to answer to their constituents anymore, because they can get money from big donors, then they just don't necessarily push for the affordable aspect of it, or, you know, throw money at it, but they're throwing money to their donors potentially to try and do something about it. And you just don't see the success. I do feel that housing issue, crisis really, is again really at the heart of it, is the lack of representative government because of money in politics. If we had Congress people and senators, you know, at the state level and the federal level that were uninfluenced by money in politics, and at the state level, it's not as bad. Let's be fair, but you'd see more actions to do something about building homes. So Slotkin says, let's build 4 million homes to catch up with the need, with the necessity that we have. I don't even know if 4 million homes does it. There's a lot more people than that, but
it's a start.
You know.
And are they going to be affordable? Like, are
people... Yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, a lot of they just build like luxury apartments that people in that city can't even afford.
Yeah, like that's a big thing. Like the luxury apartments, like new apartments are always being luxury apartments, so they can charge more. And it's like, I'm sorry, this apartment is not luxury. Like what's luxury? I think like they would have to be posh. But it's like I've lived in some luxury apartments that
Right. Yeah, it's just a big price tag. That was what makes it luxury. It keeps keeps the riffraff out.
Yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's what I think is the desired effect of some of these high price tags on the housing. Right.
Well, it's not just that. I've heard that they have like algorithms that basically tell them the best way to make the most money. And some of that's just to increase the price. And regardless of how many people can actually afford it, it's just whatever makes them the most money. So if only 50% of the housing that's built or apartments are actually rented, as long as they make more money, they don't care.
And I think one of the biggest things is like, so where's the legislation to help with this at a federal level? Was it mentioned in the State of the Union address that housing was a problem? Nope. It wasn't mentioned at all. Was it addressed at all in this massive bill that just got passed? Nope, not at all. So what's the effect of money in politics? It basically means zero legislative actions to help with this crisis.
Yeah.
You're stuck with rising housing costs, rising homelessness rates, and kids, and not just kids, adults that cannot afford a house, and you're then stuck in a renter's market, which is the way that private equity is pushing us towards, by buying up houses or apartments with all cash deals, right, in major cities, and then charging rising rates of rent and forcing people into never getting a home ownership. And let's be honest, that is the middle class. Owning your home, it's your retirement, you know, it's what you have of the roof over your head when you want to stop working, right? That's the idea. Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. I'm looking at it like I've always been a renter and I will never have that at the rate it's going. I'll never be able to own a home. I'll never have that security because it's just, I've never been in a position where I could buy a home.
And like one of the reasons I was able to afford a home was because of the VA, because they offer a zero down loan basically, but most of the the majority of the Americans don't have that benefit.
Policy. Yeah, that's really really helpful to an American building an American middle class.
Well, yeah, for a $500,000 home, usually they want 20%. What's that like? I'm trying to remember what that is.
100,000 on 500?
To be 20, 40, 60.
100,000.
100,000 for, because it's 500. I'm thinking 400 for some reason. Yeah, so like who's got that saved up, especially when everything keeps going up, rent's going up, you know.
People don't have even enough money for an emergency car repair. Like you're lucky if you have $500 saved as an emergency fund. Most people don't have that.
Yeah, let alone 100,000, saved up. And that's for 500,000, houses in California are over 1 million at this point.
And to add to it, you have to have insurance. So if you have a bank mortgage on your home, you have to have insurance. So
that's
in a few states, insurance companies are pulling out or raising their rates so much that makes it impossible to get that insurance that's needed, to get the mortgage that's needed to be able to buy a home. And that's why it's a crisis. And so I was pleased to see Senator Slotkin put it as one of her five pillars. I know for Operation Hope and the populist plank, banning private equity from home, from purchasing of private homes is one of the pillars there as well. And again, that needs to be a kitchen table issue for Americans.
Yeah.
And we need to start hearing more about it. Another area we'll switch over to maybe another, the next topic is, should we talk about energy?
Before we move on, I don't remember. Sure. Did Alyssa's, the Senator Slotkin, mention any action items or anything or how she was going to deal with those?
So she talked about regulation, like removing, reducing, undoing.
Yeah, but she didn't mention like what it looked like. Like, did she give like any type of actual plan? They're like,
no, it wasn't really specifics. It was, you know, incentives for communities to change zoning laws. It was building the 4 million homes.
Build 4 million homes, ban zoning and regulation barriers. That's just about it.
Right.
I mean, that's like, she doesn't give like, and how we're going to do that kind of thing. She just says we need to do it.
When I hear that, I feel like
the speech would have been much longer.
They can have, she could have at least, provided like a document or something for people to read. Mm-hmm. Because every time I hear that, it just sounds like, oh, they're saying, reduce regulations, but for who? For builders?
She might have one. She very well might have one. And if she doesn't, if she's outlining this as her work plan, I would certainly expect that she's going to have more specifics available. In addition to this, the 4-minute segment of this speech that she discussed, kind of the housing portion. So if she doesn't, then right on, that's a gap. But I imagine that it just wasn't part of the speech. There just wasn't enough time to get into the nuanced specifics of it, because she didn't get into specifics in really any of the pillars.
Yeah.
It was more like, these are the things that matter. And these are the things that, she focused on the Democratic Party. I think it's both parties, this is American needs right now.
Yeah.
These are critical to the American people. So if either party is leaving this off, then they're missing the mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's just, I guess, because to me, it just sounds like lip service. So I was trying to see if there was anything else to back it up. But I guess we'd have to look that up to see what else she's actually brought up, just to see how much she's actually going to do it.
And maybe this is her way of kicking it off and like trying to find people who are going to work with her, not just in the Senate, but also what groups are going to be willing to work with her. Like maybe this was her calling card in a way.
That's right. I think it is a little bit. I know. I think that, she was a House member for 6 years, one. Her Senate seat with like over or slightly over 70% of the vote. That's like a crushing win, right? I mean, that's as almost as lopsided as it gets.
Yeah.
And Trump won Michigan this past cycle. And she won as a Democrat, 70-30. So whatever she's doing is connecting with her voters out there.
Yeah.
The things that she's saying is connecting.
Yeah.
We all know that the problem is one person can't change it in the system. This is not, rightfully so, right? You don't want that. You got to get more people involved. And she's one of what I view is many more to come that support these areas. So it's just political rhetoric until you get more people on board, because you can't get that progress that you're talking about, Frank.
Right.
And like, what's her actual, specifics? So
yeah, plus we have to see her voting record and like what she's actually going to be voting for, from now on as well. Like, sure, maybe her past record might be bad, but we also have to see what she's going to do moving forward now to see if she's actually going to vote for those things. Like, even here in here in California, we're like the majority, we have like a super majority as Democrats, but yet, we can't blame the Republicans for not getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah. Which is frustrating.
Yeah, that's one of the things and I don't love the term, but in her speech, she says we have to slaughter some sacred cows of the Democratic Party. And she outlines a few different areas where the Democratic Party needs to change. And so one of those is let's see if I made some notes here. Let's see. Slaughtering sacred cows. Supporting small business is not the same as supporting massive corporations.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Moving past the talking point of comprehensive immigration reform. So like actually getting it done, I think is what you're saying there. In the knowledge that immigration helps grow your country, right? It boosts your economy. There's more consumers, there's more economic growth, there's more jobs, and you need to feed that system. And you need immigration as part of that system. So, the current plan of raising the ICE budget and building detention centers to help, prevent illegal immigration or to jail people that come to the country illegally doesn't fix the problem.
Or trying to take my birthright citizenship.
Well, if anything, it's making it worse because, at least with some immigration, you get more schools to be able to stay open. Because right now there's been a decline in kids attending schools. Mm-hmm. Like I know where my girls go, they're struggling with getting enough kids or students to come in. And because of that, their budget keeps getting lower and lower. To the point where like they're struggling to maintain teachers, maintain supplies, maintain basically enough money to continue operating. The way it's been going, a lot of it's not just like here, it's the whole district, not just our district, like around. Apparently it's a trend, with the lowering birth rate and all that. Now with less immigration, it's going to keep going, continue to go down. So that's causing even more problems. That's
a great segue into another pillar of this economic war plan.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't love the name. I'm not I don't like putting the war into the name of the plan, but that's, she's coming from the CIA and the Department of Defense. So I get it. I get the connection. And I don't criticize for it. Schools and education and Frank, that connection is so interesting because you're talking about the cost of living, right? And mm-hmm. how it reduces then the desire for people to have kids because kids are expensive, let's be honest.
Oh, yeah, very expensive.
Right? And so now you have a declining birth rate side effect, which then triggers the side effect of not having enrollment in some schools and then schools suffering because mm-hmm. of it.
Whole districts are suffering.
Yeah.
And funding then is tied to the enrollment numbers, right?
Which then, when it keeps going down, that's going to make it our education worse than it already is. We already have a lot of issues to begin with. With the budget, with this issue here, it's just going to continue to get worse. And they'll probably use this excuse to try to, push for charter schools more and more, which those have their own way more issues as well.
Yeah. And encouraging people to also homeschool, which the homeschooling doesn't have to be a bad thing, but the problem is there's no consistency.
Well, it's not just that. How many parents have the luxury to be able to do that? Like, I would love to teach my girls at home, but I don't have the skill set. I don't have the time. And I may not even have the patience for it. Like, I don't know.
But you can't also ensure that every child is getting the proper materials that they need to make sure that they are going to be good citizens.
Yeah,
that's part of what's good about public education is making sure at least everyone has a baseline that they're coming from.
And there's also like the big part of it, which is the socialization, mm-hmm. which schools, help out a lot with that. And when you went to homeschool, it's harder to do it. You could, obviously, but it's definitely harder.
Yeah. I mean, I know enough people now that homeschool that do like there's been like different kind of like cooperatives of homeschoolers that come together so their kids can all work together as well. But it's just like, why didn't you just put them in school?
That's basically school, yeah. That's basically public school. Just probably better, though.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Most of them.
They're like, basically, they're reinventing the wheel, it seems like.
Yeah, but a lot of the people I know that do it, they're coming from a more affluent background. they're coming from a more privileged background, so they can afford to do it. They can take the, you know,
for the resources, for the time, for like the extra training if they need it, or to bring people in. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they can afford the books.
Do you think that our policies right now make entering the teaching profession desirable for a lot of people?
Hell no. Mm.
I mean, ultimately, I didn't end up becoming a teacher. My training is in teaching, and I taught for a while abroad. But a big part of why I don't want to teach in the States is because of the policies and the way teachers are treated here. It's and I know that they're having a hard time getting more people being interested in the field because teachers aren't supported. Teachers, you know, the you're expected to have a master's degree level of education, but they're going to pay you like you barely have a bachelor's. They want highly credentialed, but they can't afford to give you more. But the part of the reason why they can't give you more is because it all stems down to teaching is seen as a nurturing role, and nurturing roles are never valued in this, at least in our culture.
Yeah. Not to mention that a lot of times teachers nowadays end up having to, besides the not getting paid enough and not getting enough resources, they also have, a lot of times they're paying for supplies from their own pocket because they're not, a lot of times they don't get enough for like the kids or for whatever they're trying to do. So not only are they getting a pay cut, they're using their own money to try to, you know, to pay for supplies. Or they'll ask parents, like, because I know for us, they'll be like, oh, hey, we ran out of tissue, you know, and it's flu season. If you guys could please donate. And we will, because, you know, we want our girls and the kids to be able to blow their nose when they got, you know, they're sick or they got boogers or whatever. Because I'm like to not have that in a classroom seems crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have that here as well, where there's the, you know, the checklist of items that every kid needs to bring in to help with the what would really be necessities for a school and should be covered by the budget. But
what the employer should provide it.
You know, we can get into like the what they're being taught in schools as well, and if that's hitting the mark, right? Mm-hmm. And if that's, but really, when I connect it and think about connecting it to money and politics, and I shouldn't say they, because it's not necessarily a they, but is the agenda kind of to try to dismantle public education just overall so that it can be totally privatized? Is that what the big money system wants in the long run?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it sure seems like it. It's definitely finding whatever way they can to privatize any resource that the people may benefit from, and so that they can make money off of it.
Yeah, and get the government to pay for it, mm-hmm. basically.
It's about just taking advantage. It's an exploitative system.
Yeah, but there's a lot of money to be had in education, obviously. So there's a big profit available in education. And especially with artificial intelligence and the ability to integrate that into the curriculum, teachers become expendable. I mean, I don't ever want to see this, but teachers become expendable a little bit, and you can sit a kid behind a computer screen and let them watch 3 hours of AI-driven materials, and the AI is their teacher. Mm-hmm. That's where we're at today. People are already doing that at home. So they've outsourced the homeschooling to AI. You're going to start to see more of this.
Yeah,
that's my prediction. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 3 years there isn't this creeping in to schools, if it isn't already creeping into schools. I know it's creeping into homeschooling. So,
well, what are you guys' thoughts on AI in general?
Take it back. Like, there is benefits to AI. I think it's dual purpose, right? But we need good legislation in place to make sure that it goes in the direction that we want it to go, and that benefits society.
Yeah, too much of things that we have put in place lost that element of, is it a benefit to society? And I know the founding fathers, that was something that they wanted with corporations, because they knew that corporations could be a problem, like the East India Trading Company and stuff like that. Like they'd seen it be a problem. And so they wanted corporations to have to prove that they were a benefit to society. And if you weren't, then you'd lose your charter. So it just, and we lost that along the way. And now they own us.
Unfortunately.
They kind of do. They own our government. That's
yeah,
for sure.
Sure, yeah. They own that for sure.
They kind of own a lot of what we have. Okay. Where to next? Should we go? Oh, so I should mention this. So another one of the sacred cows, and I didn't mention this as far as the higher education college, is that to slaughter the sacred cow, you don't have to go to college to be successful.
Mm.
So trade schools, working with your hands, you can be highly successful and thrive, in being a craftsman and good with your hand. And I especially think of home building and being in that area, because it's what a critical need that we have. So if you're somewhere in the home building field, whether it's plumbing, electrician, or carpentry, there's a lot of good prospects where the changing technology will not be as impactful, right? So AI is not going to be building homes anytime soon, at least, it seems like. You know, I mean, maybe with 3D printing, there's some of that, but there's still a real need. So it seems like a safer area.
It might help improve how homes are built, but it's not going to take over the actual construction of it. Yep. You know, they may be able to come up with new ideas, more efficient, effective ideas, but they're not going to. It's a safe field.
How about this one, Frank? So college loans, college debt, right? You cannot escape it. If you struggle to get a job and have to declare bankruptcy, or you cannot escape your school debt. It cannot be eliminated, right? Without really, really hard, difficult process.
Mm-hmm.
How? Why? Why is that the case? You know, what are the side effects of that? We need to make universities more affordable.
Well, because it's not just, I'm trying to remember if it was, we're talking federal loans. Is it just for federal loans or is it for all loans? It's one thing I haven't looked into.
Yeah, you know, I'm not positive. But I don't know. I think it's all loans. I think it's like any kind of Fannie Mae type loan, if that's housing, right? I don't know, whatever school loans.
Well, obviously, I think like if it's private loans, obviously that's going to benefit whatever lender is giving those out. So if you're able to file bankruptcy, and then those loans are going to go, you know, that money's going to go away for the private lenders. It would benefit schools because, you know, then they'll keep getting more and more people. If they know they have to pay the loans off, the lenders are going to be willing to continue giving those loans to students, whether or not they're going to pay, like regardless of whether or not they're going to benefit from it or whatever. So these schools are going to continue getting that money as well. And then if it's for the government, let's say if it's a public thing or a federal thing, it's a way to basically tax, you know, continue to tax poor people, because then they're going to have to continue paying for it. And so they don't have to make any tax cuts in that section.
I think like that legislation that passed to, you know, it wasn't always there. So this law about not being able to forgive that debt,
mm-hmm.
if somebody goes bankrupt, is an aspect of money in politics, right?
I believe Joe Biden was a big part of that. President
initially?
President Joe Biden, yeah. I don't know if it was initially, but I know he was a big proponent in all of it, yeah. He like helped pass it.
He was from Delaware. And Delaware is like, you know, home to many banking institutions. So he got a lot of money from those banking institutions.
Yeah.
So he's supporting his special interest.
Yep.
You know, he's doing his job, really. Let's be honest. That's what they're there to do almost. It's a sad state of affairs.
Basically.
Supposed to represent the people.
So what do we got to do? We got to get money out. We got to get money out of politics. That's why the 75 coalition is talking. That's why we're trying to do this. We're tying these things all together on this episode. A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
She has a Senator Slotkin on her economic war plan has a pillar for an all of the above energy policy, which is encompassing all the different forms, saying we need to, you know, generate the ability to create energy from all different forms, not just fossil fuels and not just clean energy, but, you know, natural gas as well, because it's needed for the rest of what we're trying to do in America, to keep the cost down, help Americans generate, you know, a strong middle class. I agree with that.
And I'm just so pessimistic because all the stuff I heard her say, I'm just hearing how they can, their wordplay, like the way she's saying it. I feel like she's saying it in a way where she's technically being honest, but the implementation is not going to be as great as we think it's going to be. I mean, and it's extremely easy to say these things when you know this freaking bill that just passed is going to basically stop you from doing many, if not all of them.
Yeah.
So if you know it's not going to pass, it's very easy to say, oh yeah, let's do this, let's do that, you know, but timing wise, I would say I'm not really liking it. Not like a lot of the other politicians that have been saying it for years and years, and you actually see them vote for things that would help out, you know. You got like AOC, Bernie is a big one, like all these guys, they've been saying it for years.
Yeah.
It's not going anywhere. It's a fact. Like with so many of these other areas, is it just not going to go anywhere because of the political system that we have in place. So as long as energy companies are able to give, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to politicians, you're not going to see the best interests of Americans in the mix, right? To what the solution should be. So, of course, we should have concerns about the rising temperature of our planet, right? Mm-hmm. We should. Like, the rising oceans are a problem. And, you know, but at the same time, we can't go all in on clean energy yet, because we still have an energy crisis, that it's costing so much to heat or power our homes and our cars that, you know, you can't go all in on one step. So it's got to be a staggered approach. But is there any path forward right now that seems like is actually realistic on this? You know, that's the sad truth. It seems like, at least, it's like a lot of talk and no action is what you're saying.
Yeah.
What I feel like too.
Yeah, like all those things that she mentioned, I feel like a lot of those got basically the bill that got passed, you know, basically make that very difficult to accomplish.
You chopped them all off at the knees.
Basically. So
it's very disheartening and discouraging, that big, beautiful bill being passed.
It really is.
It's very much like, well, what do we do now? I mean, it's almost like they're like egging us on to have a revolt. Like,
well, at this point, I feel like that's what we need.
I know.
No, like, revolt. No, Frank.
No,
revolt.
I mean, I know. I'm not saying I want it. I'm just
not,
saying.
Not that kind of revolt. Not a violent.
Trying to pretend to get it. Not a violent.
Different kind of revolt.
I think we forget it. I think we all forget it. We live in the best country in the world in terms of democracy. And it gets back to like the point of what we're trying to do with this coalition is get people that want to get money out of politics to run for office, to be empowered to speak about money in politics as a central issue. And that's what we're trying to do on this episode, is relate it back to these issues. So, you know, these other issues. Money in politics is the central one. It gets thrown in at the end of her speech in a, you know, 30-second clip.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's at the heart of every single pillar that she's putting out there. So until she starts, Senator Slotkin starts to address it with the level of urgency that it desires, like we're trying to do, and other people want to see done, then she's going to fail, because it needs to be a number one in how we kind of make progress in these other areas. It's just talking points otherwise. And Frank, and I see that's what you're saying as well. And that's at the heart of the of what your message is. It's like, does she mean it? She can't possibly mean it, because she's leaving out a key aspect to what it means to get it done. So sorry, I'll get off my soapbox.
No, I mean, isn't that the point of this whole podcast? Yeah. It's all your soapbox?
Yeah, I guess so.
That's why we're going to get... No, it's fine.
Hey, using technology, there's really, yeah, now in today's, you know, what we have available to us to get around some of these barriers to entry is great. So being able to do this and having this group that comes together to do this, you know, so it's this is how we... I think this is how we win. This is how we, one way of how we win, right? So we're one of many. And in the next episode, I want to talk about the different groups that are out there working on this. And I'll just mention right now that at the end of July, there is going to be a rally in DC. A group called Money Out of Politics is organizing July 27th in Washington, DC. And that is focused, finally one, I've been waiting for it, focused on money and politics. So yeah. I really hope there's a big turnout to this.
They're also trying to do it at the same day at state capitals as well. So in addition to DC, the state capitals.
That's great. It's great. So yeah.
That was July 27th?
July 27th.
Let's go to Sacramento, Frank.
We'll see. That's a nice little drive there. 6 hours at least, I think, for me.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it's completely across the political spectrum, where you get, you know, Republicans as far right or moderate Democrats, independents, non-voters, right, progressives. Everybody is saying money in politics. The only ones that aren't, it seems like, are the ones in power. The ones
benefiting from it, yeah.
And the media, right, that doesn't address it. So. That's what's driving everybody so getting them so frustrated, right?
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that there's a big turnout on July 27th, because that'll send a nice message and hopefully bring together a coalition to move forward, you know? So step in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, just so like, how do you say his name? Soran, his win as well. That's a big,
Zoran Mondami.
Zoran Mondami. Yeah. I was like, Sauron.
I don't know if I said it correctly, but
yeah, he's a New York City,
Lord of the Rings.
New York City mayor. So it's good to have, I think, you know, everybody in anywhere in any seat to do it. You know, obviously his reach is limited to New York City, but still, it I think it shows that. And he got on Cuomo a little bit about his fundraising in the past and the money that he's been doing. But it wasn't a central theme to his election win. He was talking about affordable housing and the cost of living.
Yeah.
You know, and I think those are critical things as well. But he didn't really get at the heart of it.
Well, that's
so much.
I feel like, because that's probably more, it probably gets a better reaction from people, because like we're talking about money in politics, but a lot of people don't understand how it's connected, or they might not fully see how big of an issue it is. But when you start connecting it to how it affects their lives, like, you know, like he did, it's easier for them to understand it, you know, because, oh, your housing, your healthcare, your schooling, like all these things are connected to that. And even if we don't, even if it's not necessarily money and politics that we're continually harping on, we can connect everything that money and politics is affecting, and so that it connects to people, everyday people, you know, because that's what they care about. They care whether or not they can buy gas, you know, to be able to go to work. And if they're making enough work to be able to make, you know, to buy food and groceries for their kids and make sure their kids.
Exactly.
Exactly. And then their kids, make sure that they can go to a good school and to be able to learn and so on.
That's the middle class. That is what we're, you know.
Yeah.
That's what's at risk right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the one thing that we didn't mention as one of the pillars is the last pillar was healthcare.
Mm.
I mean, not exactly sure where to start with the system. I mean, the insurance aspect of it,
the farms are
the sick care kind of treatment aspects mm-hmm. of it, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it's sick care, not health care.
Yeah, because it costs so much just to go see the doctor that you don't want to go to pay the $300 that it's going to cost for the appointment, you know, just to get in the door.
Anyway. It's more profitable for them to keep us sick than if we were healthy all the time. They make more money off us always being sick.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh, so gross.
Giving us all the pills or surgeries or whatever it is that yeah. they can sell us.
Pills, creams, lotions. Hmm.
There's an interesting proposal that's out there right now. So House Member Ro Khanna and I think Tom Massey, two opposite ends of the kind of political spectrum, a highly conservative Republican and a highly progressive Democrat coming together. And I don't know all the specifics about it, but wanting to make give the U.S. government the ability to negotiate on all drug prices. Right, Maggie?
That would be nice.
Yeah. 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 So the idea behind it is that I don't have all the details off the top of my head, but ultimately it's taking Trump's executive order to lower drug prices and codifying it into law. And making it a lot of it to make and you know put the see if they really mean it. Because I know Ro Khanna means it and I know we mean it. If the people
I'd like to see the collaboration between the two also.
Mm-hmm. It's a bipartisan effort that I think a lot of people can get behind. They just need to know about it and they need to let their congresspersons know, vote for it. Don't be against it.
I heard maybe a potential name. Is this
The name. The I know that there are some people that Operation Hope has nicknamed it Khanna Care after Ro Khanna. So, yeah.
There you go.
Very creative.
Not a bad name. Not a bad name. Hey, listen, making prescription drugs more affordable and knowing how much they're going to cost you before you get up to the register as well. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways that we can improve this healthcare system. A lot of different ways. Prescription drug prices is just one of many. So Senator Slotkin lays out a few other ones in her speech, right? But again, it comes down to big pharma and the healthcare industry are massive donors. And you think about all the commercials you see on TV advertising for healthcare drugs and the like, pharmaceutical drugs, you know, think about all that money that they're spending there. They're also spending to buy the politicians as well. So like, that's the game. We're not going to make any progress in healthcare reform at all until there's money in politics reform and we can restrict how much pharmaceutical companies and drug companies or healthcare companies can give to politicians. So
yeah,
hopefully, you know, this kind of movement that's really feels like it's taking hold with, you know, finally a rally on money in politics and a lot more attention now. A lot of people are just aware after seeing Elon Musk give 200 plus million to Trump. And you know, that just really put it in everybody's faces that within the next 2 or 4 or 6 years, we get that constitutional amendment that we need to undo this. Because that's the thing. This is fully within our control in America. Just as easy as signing a constitutional amendment. Drafting it is even simpler. We've already put one on our website, the constitutional amendment. We call it the People's Amendment. It's on our website. It's, you know, it's could be edited, of course, but it's something, it's a starting point, right? To get the discussion going
Yeah.
And that's simple. You know, getting people to sign it should be very simple. It should be. But of course, it's not, because special interests. special interests with the air quotes.
They're going to do their best to attack it, to do everything they can to keep it from passing.
Yeah.
We need people that believe it. You know, we need people to stand up that believe it and want to join in. So my hope is that the 75 Coalition and other groups are able to be part of that movement to really drive this, to drive this home. And that's at the heart of it. So, yeah. It was a good episode here today. You know, I think I feel pretty good about what we just talked about. Major takeaways. We talked about Alyssa Slotkin's speech, obviously. Encourage everybody to watch it. And I would like to link it to the podcast so people can just easily get to it.
It'll be in the description below.
Yeah. I should say also, right? Subscribe to the 75 podcast. Like the 75 like podcast. This is all new to me. I'm not a podcast. So I don't have the verbiage down yet.
we'll come up with some zingers.
You know, so, and if you want to become part of this movement, you know, please, there's many different organizations. You can contact us at our email address, standwiththe75@the75.us. Also through our website, you can fill out a little form, and we'll put you in touch with us as well. We have a lot of different things that we'll be working on to move forward this movement, and very exciting things, and we could use help to move these things forward. So different action items. So, and of course, you know, share if you like it, share it, and use your voice, because that's the most powerful thing that you have. Speak up, right? Don't be afraid to speak up and share and to get involved. And if you're able to, consider running for office, because really we need to put pressure on politicians to change. And the best way to do that is to be the counter to them. Mm-hmm. So to give voters another option, one that is fully supportive of changing the big money system. So,
yeah, Maggie, we don't even have to win. The more people run, the more it'll water down their money and their influence, because it'll have to spread it out through more and more campaigns. The more people do it,
So what's the term? Get caught trying.
Exactly.
And I believe that representatives do not want to participate in this system. I think it's just, it captures everybody once you're in it. Mm-hmm. It's like the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah, I was just thinking.
You don't realize until you get there. And this movie is nearly 100 years old now, but you know, you have to play within the system that's there. And so,
yeah,
it's hard. So I know that's why we're going to be successful. And we just need a little pressure and a little leadership and a little direction. And that's why we're not that far away. So, brighter days in the future. Thank you, Maggie. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Michael.
Anything that I miss?
Thank you.
Closing remarks. We good? Good to break off until the next one.
Yeah,
break.
This has been a great, you know, informal discussion. That's the idea with what we're trying to do is keep it light, and you know, there's really no wrong opinions here. So everybody has their own, and that's a beautiful thing. So let's share them. Right. Don't be afraid to talk about politics. And
I think one good thing is to let listeners know and viewers that there's the comment section. You're more than welcome to share your ideas, and we want to know what ideas you have. And if you disagree with us, let us know. Because, like, you know, it's all about figuring out what's going to work. And if our ideas aren't going to work, what are your ideas? Let's at least try and figure it out.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. The idea is to be inclusive and welcoming. You know, we want viewers. Gosh, if you want to come on the podcast, reach out, you know, share. This is a grassroots organization. And you really can't get more grassroots than this. This started from a message board. We're not funded. So this is just an awesome group of people working together, different political backgrounds working together. You know, let's keep that in mind as well. So everybody's welcome. That's the idea with the 75 Coalition. That's the idea with the 75 podcast, the 75 website, right? Is to get big money out of politics, because that's what we all want. That's what we all really desire. So thank you. Thank you, everybody. Share the podcast, like the podcast. The website's www.the75.us. You can email me at michael.hahn@the75.us. I think Maggie has Maggie.bowman.
Maggie.bowman @the75.us.
Yeah. Frank is frank.bahena. That's BAHENA. Mm-hmm. @the75.us. So you can reach out to us individually. We'd be happy to hear from you. Until next time. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, guys.